So my name is Jessica Myers. I am a statistician in the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And I want to start off by kind of setting the stage for the world in which I work. Like I said, I'm in the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology. So what that means is that our bread and butter is doing large comparative safety and comparative effectiveness studies of medications. So this is generally in large administrative healthcare databases, so healthcare claims and pharmacy claims from private and public insurers, as well as sometimes electronic medical record data or registry data. And so we usually have cohorts of tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of patients using these medications, and then we monitor those patients for adverse outcomes. So this research was supported by two different government agencies. So I'm very happy that the last speaker did a very good job of presenting propensity scores in general. So usually when we are doing these large comparative safety and comparative effectiveness studies, we rely on propensity scores to do our confounder adjustment, right? So we're getting our data from these databases that monitor medication use in real routine care. So these are not experimental studies. The patients that are using the two different medications may be very different. So we have to adjust for that. And so we usually use propensity scores. And without going into all the detail that the prior presenter did, I'm just going to focus on the advantages of propensity scores in this case, which is that Rosenbaum and Rubin showed that if we can remove the confounding by adjusting for some variables, which I call C, then we can also remove the confounding if we just adjust for the propensity score that conditions on C. And so this is really, really useful because it means that rather than having to include all these covariates in our outcome model, and in our pharmacoepi studies, we're usually talking about hundreds, sometimes even thousands of potential covariates, rather than having to include all those covariates in our outcome model, we can put them in our propensity score model. And if you have a cohort where maybe 50% of your cohort is exposed, you can estimate a very precise propensity score model and include a lot of covariates, whereas you could never include all those covariates in your outcome model, because usually if we're working with a, for example, an adverse safety outcome for a medication, we might have 1% of our population with an outcome. So there's no way we could model all those covariates in our outcome model. So this is great. It reduces a multidimensional problem to one dimension. So what does that mean for how we select our variables into the propensity score? So like I said, in our setting, we tend to have many measured covariates and also often imprecise knowledge of what is a confounder and what is not a confounder. So how do we know what to include in our propensity score model? So many people have recommended just balancing every covariate that you have measured before the exposure. So this is equivalent to selecting all predictors of exposure, and this is actually the usual approach when adjusting via the propensity score model. You know, for many years, the common wisdom with propensity scores has been that you want to do a really good job of predicting treatment, predicting exposure, and that's how you know you have a good propensity score model. Another method for selecting variables for the propensity score is something called the high-dimensional propensity score. And so this was proposed by some of my colleagues in 2009. And this looks at the empirical bivariate associations of each potential covariate with the outcome, as well as the association with the exposure. And it uses those two estimated associations to decide which covariates have the most potential for causing bias in your study. And that's helpful because it allows us to rank these thousands of covariates according to their potential for bias, and we use that to then select these variables into the propensity score. So throughout this talk, I'm going to talk about adjustment, and in general I mean adjustment through the propensity score. So I don't want to sort of lose the focus on the propensity score, and I will come back to the propensity score at the end, but throughout when I talk about adjustment, I'm really talking about adjustment through the propensity score. So more recently, some statisticians and others have come up with this idea of bias amplification, and they've actually shown that conditioning on an instrumental variable can increase both the bias and the variance of your estimates of treatment effect or exposure effect. And so there's several citations here of people that have published in the last, 7 years or so on this topic. And so what does that mean for variable selection? Well, if you're including all the covariates into your propensity score that are predictors of exposure, you're definitely going to include instrumental variables. So let's remind ourselves, what is an instrumental variable? So I have my little causal diagram here at the bottom right that shows an instrumental variable. In this case, it's this measured covariate Z. And so Z is an instrumental variable, or I might call it an IV or an instrument, because it's associated with the exposure, which is X, but it's not associated with the outcome except through exposure. So a lot of a common instrument or a common instrumental variable that we think about a lot is randomization, right? Randomization affects what exposure you get, but it shouldn't affect the outcome except through the exposure. So in this case, Z is an instrumental variable, and so you can see that if we're selecting variables to adjust for based on whether or not they predict exposure, we're definitely going to select the instrumental variable. And so that's potentially a problem if we think that including that variable in our propensity score is actually going to make our estimate worse. So what is the intuition behind this? I think this was very non-intuitive for me and for a lot of other people when they first hear about this concept of bias amplification. So we tried to sort of think through the intuition. So if we think about it, So let me also note that in our causal diagram here, the U that I have up here is an unmeasured confounder. So all of the bias is going to come from this unmeasured confounding. We haven't measured it, so we're not able to adjust for it. So what happens when I condition on my instrument? Well, the bias from my unmeasured confounder depends on two things. It depends on the association between the confounder and the outcome. And it also depends on the association between the confounder and the exposure, right? Sort of our normal confounding triangle that we usually think of. So another way to say the association between our unmeasured confounder and the exposure is to say that it depends on the proportion of the variation in the exposure that's explained by our unmeasured confounder. So what happens when we condition on an instrumental variable is we're effectively removing one source of the variation in exposure. So then the variation from our unmeasured confounder becomes a larger proportion of the total variation, and therefore whatever residual confounding from our unmeasured confounder is there, we're actually going to make that worse by adjusting for the instrumental variable. So the implications are that we condition on an instrument, it reduces independent variation and exposure, and that causes us to both increase the variance of the effect estimate as well as amplify any residual confounding bias. So if we don't have any unmeasured confounding bias, then we don't have to worry about it. We only have to worry about it if we have some unmeasured confounding, which of course, at least in the world that I work in, we always assume that we have some unmeasured confounding. So what does this mean for practice? Well, if a variable is known to be an instrument, then obviously we shouldn't adjust for it. But of course, we often don't know whether or not a covariate is an instrumental variable or not. And to make things worse, we can't use the data to verify IV status because the assumptions of being an instrumental variable depends on some unmeasured data. In addition, if there is unmeasured confounding, IVs will actually look like confounders because they'll be associated with exposure and they'll be associated with outcome independently of exposure. So then that brings up the question, what's an epidemiologist to do or an otherwise public health researcher? So we looked at an empirical example. This is a study of mortality and hip fracture among patients that initiated a statin medication versus patients that initiated glaucoma drugs. So these were all patients 65 and older in a large pharmacy claims database. So this study was done by some of our colleagues. They defined 202 potential covariates based on demographics, health system service use, and diagnoses. And they found that one covariate, which was prior diagnosis with glaucoma, was not surprisingly strongly negatively associated with exposure to statins versus glaucoma drugs. So if you had previously gotten a diagnosis with glaucoma, not surprisingly, you're getting the glaucoma drugs and you're probably not getting the statin drugs. And so they actually hypothesized that they were seeing some bias amplification when they adjusted for glaucoma diagnosis, and they thought that, that this covariate was acting like an instrumental variable in their analysis. So we looked at their data, and so what I'm showing you here are a bunch of treatment effect estimates on hip fracture, comparing statin users to glaucoma drug users. And in each case, we look at the estimate without adjusting for our potential instrument, glaucoma diagnosis, as well as after adjusting for our instrument. And so something to keep in mind when you're looking at this is that the expected, we have a pretty good idea that statins and glaucoma drugs shouldn't be affecting your risk of hip fracture. So we think that the true risk ratio should actually be, or the true hazard ratio should be at 1, which is over here way on the right side. So clearly all of our estimates are really biased. But every time we add our instrument to the propensity score, we additionally adjust for our instrument, all of a sudden our effect estimate is moving even further away from the truth. So they hypothesize that this is probably bias amplification in action. But something to think about when you're looking at this is that this instrument was a very, very strong instrument, one that we almost never see in regular practice. So the odds ratio for the association between prior glaucoma diagnosis and then treatment with a statin was 0.07, right? So this is equivalent to an odds ratio of almost 15, right? We almost never see an association that strong. And so even with a very, very strong instrumental variable, we still end up with not very large effects on our treatment effect estimates, right? So our estimates are certainly changing when we adjust for our instrument, but they're not really changing enough to change our conclusions. So we did a simulation study to try and better understand the implications of bias amplification in real practice. So I'm going to, for time's sake, skip over a lot of the details. But the most important thing to notice is that we considered simulations when our measured variable is an instrument, when it's a near instrument, so that's when it's strongly associated with exposure and only weakly associated with the outcome, and then when it's a confounder. So when it's a true instrument, it can increase the bias and variance slightly. When it's a near IV, it can also increase the bias and variance slightly, but it can also decrease the bias depending on the other associations that are at play. And of course, when it's a confounder, we're always going to get a decrease in bias by adjusting for it. So that's good. That's what we expected. So the most extreme cases, we looked at about 2,000 different simulation scenarios, and the most extreme case was a 20% increase in the bias and a 33% increase in the variance. So in general, we felt like the more important problem was unmeasured confounding. And so I'm going to go ahead and skip to that. The increases in bias were usually small compared to the crude bias and the standard error. And so we concluded that really unmeasured confounding is by far the most important problem. So when in doubt, if you don't know whether it's an instrument or a confounder, it's probably safer to assume that it's a confounder and include it in your propensity score model. So we did a second simulation study, which I'm just going to go over really briefly, which was to again, think about this in more applied context. So we used a real cohort study of high versus low-intensity statins, and we simulated the outcomes, cardiovascular events, based on the observed covariates, but we simulated it with a known treatment effect so that we could see how good our estimators were doing. So these are the results. So we looked at several different estimation models. The first was we just adjusted for age, sex, and year. And so this is in three different simulation cohorts. So on the leftmost, the true effect estimate that we're interested in is 1. In the next one, it's 1.5, and then in the next one, it's 2. So when we just adjust for age, sex, and year, we're slightly biased in each case. When we adjust for more variables, but not all the variables that we used for the simulation, we're less biased, but we are still have some bias. When we include all the variables that we used for the simulation, we end up basically getting the right answer back, which is what we would hope. So then let's skip down here to adjusting for the high-dimensional propensity score. And so this is the variable selection algorithm that I mentioned at the very beginning, where we use the empirical associations with exposure and outcome in order to select variables into our propensity score. So when we use HDPS, we again get something very close to the truth back, so that's comforting. But then we considered HDPS with and without this thing that my colleague has called Z-bias reduction. And so the Z-bias reduction means that basically we're going to remove variables that we think might be instruments. And so as you can see, whether or not we remove our potential instruments, it didn't really make a difference in our simulation at all. We get the exact same answers. And so in general, you know, it's probably worth noting that we were adjusting for about 500 covariates in each of these propensity scores, and we were only removing about 10 to 20 that we thought might be instruments. So it's not that surprising that it doesn't make a difference, but it's still comforting to know that it doesn't seem like this bias amplification is a major problem in most practical settings. So to conclude, variables that are known to be instruments shouldn't be conditioned upon. I think that's still true. But inadvertently adjusting for an instrument doesn't seem to pose a major threat to the validity of effect estimates. So in general, a very strong association with exposure may signify a potentially problematic covariate, a potential instrument. So it's safer to choose variables for adjustment based on their association with outcome. So this is the first two references as the work that is presented in this presentation, and then a lot of other references if you're interested in this. Thanks.